All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. We're going to get started here in just a minute. I'll give you a quick rundown of what we're doing. We changed our schedule up this week. So right now we are screening calls for Pittsburgh Power. So if you've got a question, a comment, a topic, anything at all, press 1 on your phone right now if you haven't done that yet. Calls and questions are starting to fill up, but you've still got a chance to get through. We're going to do 1 hour with Pittsburgh Power, and then we'll do 1 hour of general questions. So no matter what your question is, press 1 on your phone right now. We'll screen those calls. If it's a Pittsburgh Power question, we'll get to it this hour. If it is a general question, we will hold you till the next hour. So, we are almost ready to start. Hold on just a minute here. All right, here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. For the website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, getting your own authority. The list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, that's what we do here on the show. Tonight, though, is the Power Hour. So we will be taking your calls about everything, maintenance, engines, ECMs, electrical systems, troubleshooting, performance, fuel mileage, you name it. And helping out today is Pittsburgh Power. I've got Bruce joining us and Ethan and John as well. Welcome back, guys.
Hi, Ethan here, and John will be joining here shortly.
Okay, excellent. Welcome, Bruce.
And I'm here, Kevin, and thank you for having us. It's always a pleasure.
Absolutely. And I see we've got some calls piling up already, but I'd like to start the show with something that's going on over there with you guys this week. So what's on the agenda?
Well, you know, we've been doing pretty good since we started the Power Hour back up, having something new to talk about every week. So this week, believe it or not, I'm doing something that I said I would never do, and that's get involved with installing DPF filters on older trucks. And we found one that is made, it's either in Sweden or Norway, and we're pretty happy with it. A client of ours that runs a 95 Kenworth with a 5EK cat from California, and he doesn't want to give up his truck. It's gorgeous. He did a lot of research. We've been doing some research, and this just may be the one.
Well, that's exciting, and I'm glad you are getting involved, because I was doing some research and I was a little frustrated with it, and I've been hoping for a solution. You know, I tell people all the time, just stay out of California. I've even told people, if you live there, just move. Just get out of there. But there are people who, you know, either live there and they want to stay, or they have really good customers that they've built long-term relationships with. And I know they want to stay, and I know they're looking for a solution. And the last thing I want to see them do is buy a new engine. So if we could come up with a solution to make the California trucks or the, you know, the older trucks California compliant, that would be amazing.
That's what we're hoping to do. They have three different versions of this DPF. One is you just take it off and clean it. And there's two, I think, that will do a regen, but we're not. I'm not absolutely sure on how that takes place right now. So far, the simplest way is to take it off, wash it, put it back on.
Yeah, and you and I have talked about this as well. What about the idea of making that, you know, making it so we can divert around that when you're not in the state?
Well, that's very easy to do, and we can do that. I'm just wondering, will California accept that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I would think that if we had any chance of getting that passed or approved, it couldn't be any kind of an easy flip a switch in the cab. I don't think they would ever allow that. But if it was, you know, where you had to get down and maybe unbolt a pipe and move one over, and I know that would be a pain, but for some people that may be a really good solution. Because if, let's say you only run 20% of your time in California and you're able to divert it, you know, and you don't have to if you're leaving the state and you don't feel like taking it off, don't. But if you do, imagine how much longer your DPF is going to last between cleanings, and you're going to get better fuel economy when you're not in the state.
I don't want to have a guy have to switch a pipe, because that's a pain. I would rather have the switch in the dash or a quarter turn lever underneath the truck that you just reach under and pull.
Now, that might not be bad. I have a feeling that if California knows you've got a switch in the cab, I can't see him letting that fly, because then as soon as you're pulling in for an inspection, all you have to do is flip the switch, and, you know, nobody would ever, unless they were pulling in for an inspection. So I think it's going to have to be something where you at least have to get out of the truck and change it. And the other thing is, I don't know how you even go about getting this approved.
Well, I say you do it. And then if somebody gets checked, say, well, this is how I run the other 48 states or 49. And when I'm in California, I run through the DPF. I'm abiding by your law. And then let the guy that pulled them over make the decision and see what happens. But that's all. I'd rather do it first and ask second.
That's exactly what I was going to say. So I'm glad you said that and you feel the same way. If it were me, I would build it, and I would use it, and I would wait until I was questioned about it.
That's exactly how I'm going to do it.
Excellent.
Yeah, Kevin, I've always wanted to build a diesel-electric semi-truck, and we're back on the drawing board with that. It's a little premature to be talking about it, but I'm looking for funding for it, and I had a long meeting today with a group of people that are interested. Then people say, well, is it legal? Well, I don't know. It's the same as a locomotive. Let's build it. Let's test it. Let's let a couple owner-operators use it, and then we go from there. It's a semi-truck going down the highway. The fact that it's an electric motor turning the drive tires versus a ring and pinion, what's the difference?
Yeah, I don't see why. Well, I mean, you never know with regulations, but like you say, build it and see if it works and worry about the rest of the stuff later. You know, you and I looked at one at Louisville one year. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, that had that little John Deere, and I told them that little four-cylinder John Deere would not make enough electricity, because a few years prior to that, spent time with a company that makes earth-moving equipment, and their rule is, it takes the same amount of horsepower to turn the generator to make electricity as it would to drive the truck down the highway. Well, that is true in a way, but we could do this with a an 11.1 liter Detroit or an M11 Cummins or C12 Cat, but we're going to keep the RPM and given up, let's say 1400. And a diesel engine is its most fuel efficient at given output. So what I want guys to try to do is leave the cruise control off, and when they're in rolling hill situations, hold that throttle steady and let the vehicle speed vary, not the turbo boost. Let's say they're going to hold it at 12 or 14 or 15 pounds to get over these little rolls, just to see what would happen, and I bet the fuel mileage goes up.
You would think so, and you're right. There are a lot of cases where, you know, diesels are used in stationary generator-type, pump-type operations where that engine is set at a certain RPM, runs like that all the time. They last a long time. They get great fuel economy. So that would be an interesting setup.
Right. So if anybody has $1 million they want to invest in this project, I'm all ears.
Well, let me look under the couch cushions and in my pockets when we're gone. We'll see what we can scrounge up.
You know what's amazing is 2 years ago, Walmart came up with that concept truck, right? It was supposed to do 14 miles to the gallon. Where is it? What have you heard about it?
Not only did they come out with that last year, I'm thinking back to like 2008, I believe. I remember attending a press conference and reading a big article, and Walmart committed back then for the year 2015, which is gone, they were going to have a truck that would get 15 miles to the gallon. And then after that, I never heard anything about it. And then the concept truck came out, no real testing, but it was nowhere near 15 miles to the gallon. And now it's gone. Cummins and Peterbilt and that other group did the same thing. They made a big deal out of the fact that they got 10 miles to the gallon, but it was a very short run, a couple hundred miles in the Southwest under perfect conditions. And they spent $1 million to get it. I mean, we have owner-operators who do that.
That's right. Dwayne Urquhart can hit it when he runs Wisconsin to Iowa, back to Michigan and back when the wind's not blowing. He puts that 10.1 out of that T600 with our 12.7 in it.
Exactly. Hold that thought. We're going to get to a break. We'll be right back. Stick around. We'll get to some of your calls and questions right around the corner. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Joining me today, this is the Power Hour. Bruce and Ethan and John from Pittsburgh Power helping out with your questions. Bruce, we've got questions lined up. Do you want to get some to some, or do you guys have anything else?
I just want to say one thing. If somebody wants to step up to the plate and help us with the diesel electric truck, we'll have it going down the highway within 6 months.
That would be awesome. I'll start working on it, see what I can come up with.
Okay, all right.
All right, let's
let's go to the questions.
Let's do that. We're going to start off in New Jersey. Oh, no, hold on. I think there's a note there that says don't take that one. Let's go to Utah. George, welcome to the program. Oh, let me got to hit the right button.
Here.
George, go ahead.
All right, we're there.
Yep.
Okay, good deal. Good morning or afternoon, gentlemen. I got a N14 here as I sit right now. I got $1,995,000 on it. It's never been rebuilt. We've had the heads off once to do the gaskets. I'm running OPS, all that happy stuff. Power Pittsburgh three flow muffler and fleet air filter. Right now it's showing a little bit of fuel dilution. And I was planning on getting this thing in to get rebuilt sometime this year. What are the kind of things we need to watch out for? Are we going to be running into any situation where I pull into the shop and all of a sudden this thing's a boat anchor instead of a viable, buildable block?
No. What you want to look out for, you do. I at this point, I would do an out-of-the-chassis rebuild. I would resurface the block. I would do the line bore, but you want, have you been changing the torsional damper on the crankshaft?
Yes, I think we've put three of your dampers on so far.
Good, because that should eliminate the fretting of the main bearing caps to the block. But that's what you want to look for. That's the main thing you want to look for in the N14, where the main bearing caps get up against the block. You want to make sure that that's a nice smooth surface and not fretted. And you'll see the fretting if it's there. If it is there, then they just machine it and do the line bore, and you're okay. But
okay,
resurface
so
the block, square the block, Magnaflux it, and rebuild it. Polish
okay.
Magnaflux and straighten your crankshaft, and you're good to go. Charles Bradshaw, he's out of North or South Carolina. He went over 2 million miles on his N14 and never rebuilt it also. So you're doing good. You're the second person that I know that's hitting the 2 million mile mark.
Right. Okay. Well, that's kind of what I want to know. Oh, the other thing is, what kind of lead time do we need for making appointments there in Pittsburgh?
Oh, for a job like that, we'd like to have 2 weeks' notice.
Oh, okay. And we're looking at, what, about 3-4 weeks of downtime?
Yes, give it a month. By the time you get the engine out, get it stripped, you get it to the machine shop. The machine shop has it for a week. You get it, takes another week to put it back together and a few days to put it in. So you have to allow 1 month.
Okay. That's what I need to know.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Have a good day.
Go ahead, Bruce.
You see what happens when people change that torsional damper every 500,000 miles, how you can extend engine life?
It's pretty amazing. You know, 1.9 plus million miles without really touching the engine, no in-frame. That's pretty amazing. He had an OPS, keeping the oil nice and clean, changing that crankshaft damper. He said three times, which would be right.
Three times?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about that, the cost is, it's not even pennies. It won't even show up on your cost per mile when you get that kind of mileage out of the engine because you took care of it.
I get people with 1.2 million miles on their engines, never change the damper. It makes me cringe whenever they do that.
Well, I mean, what do you think the numbers are? Don't you think about 98% of the trucks on the road past 500,000 miles, past 5 or 6 years, still have the original dampers? Nobody ever changes them.
People don't, and the mechanics and service managers they talk to at their dealerships have the same attitude. Oh, we never change those things. That's because those people never get out of their cocoon. They never go to the Louisville show. They don't study. They don't listen to your radio show. They don't read the articles that I write. They just go to work and do what they've always done and always get what they've always got or less.
Now, I want to ask you a question just to make sure that I wasn't missing something, because I had a call the other day and it made me think. It was a Cat 2WS who had been in the shop, and I had asked about the crankshaft damper because we had an issue and I thought the damper might have been causing it. And he said, I specifically asked the Cat engine shop and they told me, you don't have to change this damper because it's gel filled.
Well, that's what they all are. That's
what I
not
thought.
Gel.
That,
so they are making a mistake, and the silicone does get hard. My God, take a tube of silicone, take the lid off of it, use it one time, put the lid on, put it back in your toolbox, and go back a year later and see what happened to it.
Yep.
Hard.
How we used to test the old Cummins dampers before you were selling these, we'd have to take a mic to them. When the silicone would get hard, it would expand, and that's how you knew that it was bad.
Ah, yep. Interesting.
We would mic
remember
them
those
at 12
days?
Threes. Yep, we'd mic them at 12. We'd clean the paint off. We'd mic them at 12, 3, 6, and 9 o'clock. Back then, these dampers were back in the 80s, the early 80s and late 70s. They were $800 and $900, so the prices come down to half of that. But you'd mic them at 12, 3, 6, and 9, and what was it? They varied more than 3 or 4 thousand, say, were junk?
Yep. Yeah, that was it. That means the silicon had hardened up and was expanding inside of there.
So,
now
well,
go ahead.
Yeah, well, when he said gel, I thought, boy, is there something I don't know? Because I knew they were silicon. I knew the silicon gets hard. But I thought, maybe there's some damper out there with some other material that I'm not aware of. But it doesn't sound like there is.
No.
Nope.
Got it. All right. Well, I recommended he get one because he had some issues, and it certainly sounded to me like he needed one, and he was past a million miles. Let's go to New Jersey. Danny, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. How are you doing today?
Good.
Hey, I have a comment. The gentleman that was just on with the damper issue and then the comment that Bruce made about the silicone tube, the other day I put a front door on my house and I had a tube of caulking that I wanted to use. And exactly that, I put it on the caulking gun and I was pressing so hard that I actually broke the handle on the caulk gun because it did get hard. And I just hope that I had the luck that that he had as far as the damper goes with my motor, because I have the Pittsburgh damper and the Mercury balancer on my truck, and I stopped all the vibration that this truck had, so that's a good thing. But other than that, I have an oil sample that I want you guys to look at, and then I have a question for Bruce or Ethan. I did a lot of modifications on my truck, on my engine, the leads and everything, and I was wondering if I was to get a Pittsburgh power box put on my truck, would it help me, and how would it help me?
Okay, which engine do you have?
I have a C15 Acer 2007 has gone on it.
And it's a single turbo now, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, how many pounds of turbo boost can you make at 1,700, 1,800 RPM, foot flat in the floor, pulling a mountain?
I haven't brought it up that high as far as the RPMs go. I always try to keep below 15. But when I'm at around 15, I'm about 26, 27.
Okay, so you're not making a lot of power.
No, because I have a tuner, and the tuner that I have, I try to keep it on economy and power, which would take a lot of the power away from it. But if I was to put it on power, I'll get it up to 30.
30. Okay, 30 is basically about 500 to 525 horsepower. You might be touching 550. But 550 we generally see is 32 pounds of turbo boost out of the cat. The power box would help you, yes. It would give you a little more response if you need response, and it would certainly give you more pulling power.
Well, I've noticed on when I do the tuning and I change it to the power, I pull hills. I never switch. I never drop a gear at all. I just crawl right up the hill, no matter how much weight I have.
Hold that thought. We're going to get to a break. We'll come right back and get to more of your calls and questions. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. I have Bruce and Ethan and John joining me from Pittsburgh Power. And before the break, we were talking with Danny in New Jersey. Danny, go ahead.
Yeah, so my question is that if with the tuning that I put in that I have on a tuner, and I could do multiple tunings, my max is about 5525, which you're correct on it because the engine was a 435 before I did all this work to it. So so how much more can I get with the power box if it was done?
Oh, it would give you an extra 210 more horsepower if you ran it on power level setting 7.
Wow.
So, you know, I would run it on probably 2 or 3. The average Caterpillar guy runs it on power level 3. Kevin even got to drive it when it was an A-cert. Peterbilt pulling the three-axle low boy. Empty weight was 57,000. We were in Colorado, and Kevin can even tell you the differences. When I was working the remote, when I take it to zero, Kevin was looking at the throttle wondering what was wrong because he's pushing on the pedal and nothing's happening. So we'll let Kevin talk about that.
Yeah, that was an interesting test. We're in heavy traffic heading out of Denver up through the mountains. They call it the foothills there, but it's mountains and 2-lane and lots of traffic, and I'm trying to get used to this truck that I've never driven before and really long, heavy, empty. And I'm trying to get used to the truck, Bruce is back there playing with the power box, which was, you know, kind of interesting because one time I'd go to shift the gear, get all kinds of throttle response. The next time I'd go to shift the gear and feel like somebody disconnected the throttle. What an amazing difference the power box makes on that engine.
Well, my whole thing is I run the Northeast. I mean, this is all I run. I run from New Jersey to Maine. My lightest load is a Walmart load that I do. My other load that I do is a hazmat, and that's usually 40,000 pounds. And I go to, like, when I say Northeast of Maine, I go to the Northeast of Maine. It's off of the 95. I mean, I'm off the road, and I'm going up some hills that I'm actually looking at the sky. And, I mean, those... Before I actually did all this work to this engine, to this truck, I mean, I would have to downshift to almost down to sixth gear just to, you know, get up the hill. And when I got to the top of the hill, I was doing like maybe 30 miles per hour, sometimes 25 miles per hour. Now, I get up the hill and I follow what Bruce says, you know, as far as, you know, rolling those hills with the fuel pedal and stuff. And when I get to the top, I'm at 50, 55.
Yeah, you'll love the power box.
Yep, that's my next biggest purchase.
There you go.
Okay, thank
good
you.
Stuff. Let's see. We are off to Florida. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, Bruce, and guys. I've got a C15 Cat and MBN that, Bruce, you reflashed the ECM about 5 years ago, and, of course, it's phenomenal. I never realized it so much because you get used to driving the truck until last week. I had to borrow a friend's truck with a 14-liter Detroit, pulling the same load I was just did, and I thought I had the brakes dragging. It just like, anyways, my question is, it's a 6x2 with the original 20K rear end in it, and I'm going to go to a 23K full locking, and I'm undecided between the 264 and the 273.
With the Caterpillar, do the 264. By all means, with the Cat, do the 264 because we have the more lugging power there. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, I'm 355s now, and I'm just about 1,400 RPMs at 60 miles an hour, and that's where I'd like to stay.
Well, the interesting thing about going from the 355, and I agree with Bruce on the Cat, the 264 is the way to go. You, whatever RPM and speed match you have in top gear now, you will be almost identical to that in direct. There's very little difference. So it's really easy to know where your RPM is going to be at any given speed in direct. Once you make that gear change, it's going to be almost identical to what it is in top gear now.
Okay, and that's exactly what I'm looking for. So 264 is the way to go.
Yep.
Right. Hey, how many pound of turbo boost can you make on a hard pull?
About 38 to 39 hard pull.
38 to 39. And I'll do a calculation here and tell you what that horsepower is.
While Bruce is calculating, I'll do a little song and dance and keep everybody entertained.
600, well, I got it, 670.
Wow.
670, wow.
670 at 30. So you can see whenever I wrote that first article, get the bridge off the cat's back, that's a great engine. That's a great engine once you set it up so it can run free. Did you gain the mile to the gallon?
I've started out with at 5.42 on a 30-day average with this engine, and through all the improvements between the ECM, the air filters, your mufflers, wide singles, I'm about 7.5 on during the spring and summer, and wintertime now I'm about 6.9 on a 30-day average, and this is in a W900 also.
So back when fuel was $4 a gallon, you were saving $50,000 a year.
Hey, even at $1.50 a gallon, I haven't changed my style. I still drive 58 if I have the time, 60 miles an hour if I'm in a hurry. It's a challenge. What can I do? How can I make it better?
I don't care
if it was free fuel.
That's outstanding. Hey, Bruce, what about all those guys that say none of this aftermarket stuff works?
You know, I wanted to mention that earlier, Kevin. I still, after 39 years of doing this, I still have people that say I'm full of crap or this doesn't work and that doesn't work. And, you know, whenever I find out who they are and I call them, they don't have any of our products.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Well, guys,
you know,
that don't like super single, everyone that badmouths a super single tire, I always say, did you ever drive them? The answer is no. How can you badmouth something you've never tried?
We hear it all the time here. All the time. People are experts on something they know nothing about. It's amazing.
I have a question.
Yeah.
My biggest fear is if this engine has to go into a shop for emergency and them getting a computer and wiping out that program, is this something that can still be redone or has EPA knocked that out?
No, that can be fixed.
Okay. Well, that's one of
the thing is, if you have a problem, and I'll tell you, those bridge caps just don't break once they're set up right. Likewise, whenever you take a 6NZ or a 2WS and build them right, even from 95 through 2007, the cat engine's a great engine when it's set up properly. But if you have a problem and you're out in the road, call us. We might know an independent shop that we can send you into.
Oh, definitely we'll do that then. I just, by the way, just turned 900,000 miles, and I'm running about 2 gallons of oil every 25,000 miles.
2 gallon every 25. So you're going to hit the 1.5 million or more.
Yeah.
That's what I'm hoping for. And I do have your balancer and your dampener on there. It's been on there since I bought the truck at about 600,000.
Good. You're almost time for another one then, huh?
Another 200,000 miles. Need about another 3 or 4 years.
Okay. Fantastic.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Hey, if you ever get
in Western PA, stop and see us.
We are off to Georgia. Jesse, welcome to the program.
Hello, gentlemen. How's it going today?
Good.
I have a 09 Peterbilt with a 08 model cat in it, and I know it's not your favorite, but it's what I have for my heavy haul operation. I need to do some upgrades to it and get it ready, but I'm thinking of planning it for during the CMC. Are you guys going to be doing anything while we're there?
At the
Bruce,
CMC?
Bruce, this is something I need to talk with you about. One of our big challenges, you know, in Kansas City, we had been there 7 years. We had a great relationship with an excellent shop, T&E. People were very, very happy with them. And in Council Bluffs, I know nobody. And I'm looking around the area, and all I'm finding are either the shops at the truck stop there or the dealers. So if you know of anybody around there, we're looking for somebody to do the work during the CMC.
We may be able to do some. Ethan, you're going to be there with your laptop. Will you be able to do anything for that SDP cat?
Hold that thought, and we will come back and talk about that right after this. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, a quick heads up. We're heading into the fourth segment that will wrap up this first hour, but we're going to do another hour, so don't go away. We'll get to as many of the Pittsburgh Power questions as we can. Then we'll come back. We'll do an hour of general questions. So here we go. Welcome back. This is the Power Hour. We've got Ethan, John, and Bruce from Pittsburgh Power. And before the break, we were getting with Jesse in Georgia. And I think, Bruce, you were asking Ethan if he might be able to do that at the CMC.
Yeah, it depends on this current horsepower setting, too, there, all that we can do. And I'd have to look up exactly what it is, because we don't see too many SDP cats there.
It's set at 550 for now.
But what's your horsepower at?
550.
Okay. I can't remember the exact numbers on there, to be honest with you there, because it's been a while since I've seen one. If you go ahead and give me a call there, and even if you leave me a message, I'll call you back, and I'll be able to answer that with exactly what we can do.
All right.
Yeah, we're in the middle of a project move right now, and I don't foresee any downtime probably until the end of April, early May. So I'm trying to plan ahead. And if we can get things done in that time frame, that'd be awesome. I wanted to start with a dampener and getting the ECM flashed if possible. But this thing screams down the road. I've got some pretty high gears in here, too, and I hate running at high RPMs like I do, but I've got no choice there.
Yeah. Yeah, that was unfortunately the engine that put CAT out of the North American truck market.
Yeah, it is. It is. This one does okay. Like I said, I'm running 390 gears right now, and that's going to be a project for when it's time to lower those a little bit, maybe go up to 370s. But like I said, I do heavy haul, so I kind of keep them a little bit short.
What's your gross weight when you're at your heaviest?
At my heaviest, about 130.
130, yeah. A 370 or even a 355 if the engine setup would work for you.
Yeah. Well, right now I've got two-speed rear end in here, which I can flip the switch and go to 510s if I need it, and obviously I rarely ever need it unless I'm off-road.
Yeah, it's a shame you don't have a 355, 510 or something like that.
Hey,
that
Bruce.
That would be awesome.
Even in the heavy haul, because he's got the two speed, could we go down to the 264s or 279s, and he's got the 510 for the startability?
I don't think that you can have that large of a spread in the axle housing itself.
That could be. That could
yeah,
be.
That would be a question for Eaton.
Yeah. That would be interesting. All right, let's try to get to a couple more calls before we've got to wrap this up. Let's go to Indiana. Greg, welcome to the program.
Hello, good morning.
What's on your mind today?
Well, I got a question. I switched from conventional oil to synthetic in my truck,
and I got about 0.3 mile difference in my fuel economy, but I just went with partial synthetic. If I go to full synthetic, is that going to change more, or is that just how much you get from going with synthetic?
Probably not enough to notice or to measure. In fact, your 0.3 is more than normal. It's usually about 2 or 3%, which works out to, you know, 1.5 to 0.2, which is sometimes hard to measure. So if you got it 3, and we see it once in a while, if you got 3, that's good. But going to a full synthetic instead of the blend, you're not going to notice any more difference.
That's what I thought. Okay. I've got another question.
Sure.
Do you have a power box that will go on a 2016 Freightliner Cascadia that's got low horsepower? And this is another thing I don't understand that I've tried to explain to people. If you've got a big engine, you can run a small gearbox. If you've got a big the opposite. If you've got a small engine, you need to run a big gearbox. Well, the company I work for has got low horsepower on this engine and a 10-speed transmission. If you boost the horsepower on the motor, will you still get better fuel economy, or can you get better fuel economy?
You always get better fuel economy when you increase the horsepower, so long as you drive it appropriately. If you want to be like the cattle haulers and drive 75 and sometimes 80, then the answer is no. But if you drive it properly and you use the power to roll it like a roller coaster on the rolling hills, yes, you get an increase in fuel mileage.
Okay. And would the power box do that if they've got one available for this truck?
Yes, it will. I think it's the same power box that we're doing for the DD15, and we just came up with a glitch the other day that we're working on, so just hold tight for a couple weeks and let us get that worked out.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right, hey, let's go ahead, Bruce.
Hey, John, do you want to talk about the DPF that you've done some research on?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, because we talked about it earlier and you weren't on, and I know you did the majority of the research. You might want to talk about that before the show's over.
I'd love to.
Go ahead.
Now would be the time. Okay. We had a customer in here yesterday with a beautiful 2001 Kenworth W900 with a C16 in it. Minor tuning, you know, just a little beyond stock, but well taken care of, beautiful truck. The guy has no interest in getting rid of it anytime soon and doesn't need to. But he runs California. He hauls jet engines, and he runs California, and he'd like to continue running California and would like to make him legal for doing that. So we've done some research on a DPF system that comes out of Europe. It's a retrofit. It's a they call it also like my EGR canister that I want to build, the EGR soot knockout. It's a passive filter as well. It's nice and free-flowing, and it regenerates at a very low temperature. So it's going to be a retrofit and something that is CARB-approved and legal. So for some of our owner-operators with older trucks, or maybe some that have done some other work to them, we might be able to provide a product to get you back into California.
That would be excellent. And I'm sure there isn't any reason. I love the idea on old trucks and guys that want to keep them, but it would also make a glider CARB compliant, correct?
Exactly. Yeah, that's I really like that idea.
Yeah,
you see
so
where
we
I'm going
can
with it.
Build somebody a new truck with, you know, better engine technology and still be CARB compliant.
Right, for another 5 or 6 years anyway, I believe. I don't know when CARB is going to go to the 2010 specs, but I think we've got at least till 2020 or beyond. So that's quite a few years of service.
Yeah, definitely. I love that idea. And I'm glad you guys are doing the research. I started a couple times, got very frustrated with it. So I'm glad you guys are coming up with something.
I find no reason that with careful tuning that we can't build things that are efficient, you know, get great fuel mileage and are clean. I don't see why we can't do both. As we said before, we don't have the same constraints that the manufacturers have to work with, and we could think outside the box a little bit and make the same things happen.
Certainly makes sense to me. Let's try to squeeze in another call. Let's go to Arkansas. Bob, welcome to the program.
Hello, gentlemen. I got a quick question on an ISX 2012. I had a DPF delete done on it from the folks out there, their program out in Utah. I talked to a friend of mine at Cummins. He told me there's a campaign at one time on the fuel pump for a ceramic plunger, and he suggested I get it in and get it done, but he couldn't do it because of that delete. And before I got anything done about it, he said Cummins came out and I guess rescinded that campaign, and they're doing something different where they're lowering some pressures. My question is, do I need to worry about that with that delete program that I had done? Are you familiar with it? Would that have already addressed it?
Well, I'm not
familiar with it. Leave that to Ethan or Bruce.
Okay, you don't know what company I'm talking about?
Oh, we know what company you're talking about. But,
okay.
And we don't have a problem. We can work on it. If you want that ceramic plunger put in your fuel pump, no problem. Bring it to the shop, and we can do that for you.
Well, my question is, they said that ceramic plunger was shattering and causing a major issue with the contamination going through the truck, the motor, and then I should replace it.
We're going to run out of time. Let me give you a quick history on what I know about this, and it was from a caller who had it happen and did a lot of research. Cummins was losing engines again, and they came out and said it was the ceramic plunger and the fuel pump coming apart and then taking the engine down. And then later they did rescind that, and it turned out that it was the oil jets that were for the bottom of the pistons were clogging with soot, and they were wiping out cylinders. And the problem is the same thing that when the fuel or the oil filters are clogging and you're getting increased oil pressure, not enough oil flow. So I don't think that addressing the ceramic plunger does any good. I don't think that anything they did on their delete and their programming is going to do any good. So I do know some history on it, but I don't know what the solution is. Guys, there's the music. That means we're all out of time. Bruce, you want to give the phone number for Pittsburgh Power real quick?
724-360-4080.
Excellent. And thank you, guys, and we'll see you again next week.
Talk to you next week, Kevin.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, we're going to start a second hour of general questions. Here we go. If you've got, if you were on hold with Pittsburgh Power questions and I get that far down the list, I'll do my best to answer them. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. Calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. The list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, you're in the right place. That's what we do here. And during the week when we only have an hour, it usually flies by pretty quick. So I'm going to get to as many calls as I can. We're going to jump right into them and start off in Oklahoma. Stuart, welcome to the program.
Fair tax yesterday there, Kevin.
Absolutely. What's on your mind today?
I got a gearing question. Got a Detroit 11.1 liter. Got 411 gears, 10-speed overdrive, running 22, 5 tall. At 55 miles an hour, I'm sitting at 1450 RPM. All right. Bring it up to 60, I'm running close to, you know, closer to 1500. But I'm getting better fuel economy at the 1500. Yep. Under a load, under a heavy load, should I? What do you think on that speed for fuel economy?
I would just play with it. You know, as crazy as it sounds, those 411 gears, if you're willing to drive 55 to 63, those are ideal. I mean, I for that 11.1, I wouldn't change a thing. And then just play around with, you know, in different situations where you're getting your best fuel economy. But that 11.1 likes to run in that 1450 to 1550 range.
Just wasn't sure I wasn't getting too far outside the power band there. Next question is about leasing onto a carrier. I was looking at Landstar and got approved through them, but someone brought up a valid point while I was getting my DOT done that I don't know how to say it without sounding crass or, you know, bad or anything like that, but they said Landstar will let you kind of fail in a heartbeat if you don't have your stuff together. And for a brand new owner operator, someone just getting started out, what do you think? I mean, is
no,
that true?
No, it's not. It's not true at all. Or maybe it's slightly true, but I'll explain what I mean by that. I have been working with Landstar for a couple decades now. And when I first started going over there and doing some seminars and working with their guys, I used to say that the first year over there can be really difficult. It's a new system. You're on your own. You've got to do a lot of work yourself that you may not be used to doing. It's not like you pick up the phone, call somebody, and they tell you where to go. I mean, you stay home if you want. If you want to go somewhere, you go look for a load. But that's changed. I don't say that anymore because over the years, Landstar has done an amazing job of putting resources in place so that you're not just on your own. They have they have classes, they have lots of help, they have, you know, they've improved their technology to make it easier. They're not going to let you fail. Now, if you choose not to take advantage of any of those resources and you don't figure out the system, well, then you might fail. But it's not because they're not providing what you need to help. You just have to get involved, take the classes, pay attention, use the resources that are available, and you're not out on your own at all.
All right. Someone like me that came from a load planned company, and stuff like that. I know it's going to be a huge adjustment. I just want to make sure that I'm not getting way in over my head or anything like that. And I know you say they got classes, but I just wanted to get, you know, the real opinion.
You're not in over your head at all. In fact, you are just knowing you, talking to you, taking your questions on the air and helping you through this process. You are well above the curve. Most guys going over there aren't nearly as prepared as you are. They're not asking the right questions. They're not thinking about this stuff. So just the fact that you are tells me you're going to go over there and in 60 days, you're going to feel like you're right at home and you're going to start to get this stuff. So if you've been approved, I would go give it a shot. And I think you're going to find a home.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, thank you, Kevin. I surely do appreciate it, man.
You're welcome. Congratulations. Now, it's tough to get on over there. I don't know what the numbers are anymore, but the last time I talked to them, it was like 3% that apply get approved, 3 out of 100. So it is a good system. Let's go to Tennessee. Justin, welcome to the program. It's your turn.
Hey, bud. Got a question for you. If you can look at my fuel gauges, my profit, my question is, I always listen to you talk about you know, if you don't make like $45,000 a year profit and stuff like that, there's no sense in incorporating. But this year here, I made quite a bit of money, and it wasn't even a full year. And then I also plan on putting two more trucks on with this company, which would be between a $10,000 and $13,000 a month profit off each of them trucks. So I was talking to Brittany.
Well, hold on. Before we get ahead of ourselves here, I'm looking at your January numbers right now in profit gauges. And tell me a little bit about the operation.
Okay. January was a messed up month. I got rid of one driver back in September, just hired another driver in January. So I got out late for the month. I was part solo, and then I got stuck in Joplin, Missouri for about a week till he was ready to go. And it was just a messed up month. Normally what I do is I head out the first of each month. I get my 18,000 miles and go home. So I'm usually between 18 and 20,000 miles between 19 and 23 days. And then I take the rest of the month off. And I pay my driver a 50-cent split. So they make anywhere between $4,500 and $5,000 within that period of time. And my profit is usually right around $14,000 to $15,000. We get an 8-cent bonus, anything over 18,000 miles. That's why I work it the way I work it. The bonus gets paid out the following month.
So what kind of freight is this?
General freight.
Some of the numbers just aren't making sense, and I want to get clear on this. I can't see how with drivers – now, if you have a truck, you've got a team in it, right?
Now I do. Yeah, I'm back teaming now.
Well, and you said you're going to put on extra trucks and you'll have teams on those.
Yeah, only teams, because solos, your profit is only about $3,000 a month. With teams, you know, your profit after paying them, you know, 50 cents a mile for a team, your profit would be anywhere between, you know, $10,000 and $13,000.
I'm having a hard time understanding that. I've looked at a lot of numbers and a lot of trucks. I had trucks with drivers. I had teams. And I will tell you, I have yet to ever see, ever. None of my teams could do it. I have some specialty teams. And nobody generates $13,000 a month profit after all expenses. I've never seen it. And in general, I don't see how the numbers could possibly work out.
That's the way it works out. I don't know if you can look at the whole year's revenue. You know,
Tell me what you make per mile on all miles on one of these trucks. The only report they pulled up for me was January, and what I'm seeing in January is only $1.11 a mile.
How it works is it's 95 cents a mile, okay?
Yeah.
And then if you get your 18,000 miles, it's $1.03 a mile because you get 8 cents a mile paid for all the miles. Now, the company I'm leased with, we don't pay nothing. We don't pay fuel taxes. We pay nothing. My fuel is between, you know, $1.30 last month, sometimes up to $1.50, depending where I fuel at, what state. The only thing I pay for at this company is the $5.50 a year heavy real fuel tax.
Okay, hold that thought. I'm going to come back because the numbers just aren't working. They're not even going to be close to what you're thinking for profit. Now, it doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, but we need to get a handle on numbers here. So when we come back, I know what the rate is. We'll call it $1.03. We'll assume you're getting all 18,000 miles every month. But I need to know what your fuel surcharge is right now, and then I'll tell you what you could really expect for profit. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Before the break, I was talking with Justin in Tennessee. So, Justin, let's call it $1.03 a mile. What is the fuel surcharge roughly right now?
12 cents right now.
At $1.15. Now that wouldn't be all miles, but we're going to count it as all miles right now, just because it'll get us close. On 18,000 miles a month, you'd make just over $20,000. Now, if you were in the truck yourself and didn't have to pay any driver, and obviously you can't do that. You can't do 18,000 miles a month, but let's just forget the month. If you were in the truck and you drove and you made $1.15 a mile and you generated $20,000 in revenue, about the best we could hope for profit-wise is about half of that. That'd be $10,000 a month. But that's not paying any drivers. Now, if you have to pay them 50 cents a mile and you have two drivers in there, that's going to knock out the other 50% of what we already had. So instead of $10,000 a month, you could clear about $5,000. And that's if everything goes right. That would be best case scenario. So I don't know where that $13,000 is coming from, but if you budget on that, you're going to have a problem.
I pay myself $1,100 a week. The rest of it goes in. And, you know, I mean, there's times we get $300 here, you know, for like staging time for certain loads like UPS and Conway freight loads. And, you know, extra little pays here and there, but yeah, I mean, it comes up to, you know, that's why I get deposited in my account each month, every week.
But something's wrong.
That's why I was hoping she was going to give you my yearly.
I have somebody trying to pull up the year now because all I got was the month. But even on the, you know, you said you didn't get as many miles, but that's okay. That's the beauty of calculating things by the mile. Doesn't matter if I'm looking at a month that had 5,000 miles or 50,000 miles. All I have to adjust for is the fixed cost. Everything else would stay the same. But even if I had no reports in front of me, you just have to do the math. On $1.15 a mile, there is no possible way to generate the kind of profit you just mentioned. The math doesn't even come close to working. The driver, if we take the gross revenue and all we do is pay the drivers, you don't have that much profit left. Now we have to pay for fuel and maintenance and truck payment and insurance and all those other things. I mean, the math just isn't sense.
Yeah, the trucks are cash. You know, like I got a 99 Volvo.
That's fine. So we don't have a truck payment, but fuel isn't free. Maintenance isn't free. Tires aren't free. Base plates aren't free. Insurance has a cost. And I'm showing you that if all we did was pay the drivers, you don't have $13,000 left in profit.
Okay.
It's about $5,000 in profit a month is all I would count on. Now, you might be able to do a little better than that. And if there are some, but, you know, $300 staging here, there doesn't make a big dent when we're talking about, you know, starting with 20,000 and trying to end with 10.
That's really
difficult to do if you're driving the truck. When you have two drivers you have to pay, it's virtually impossible.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, after paying my driver $31,000 last year for about 7 months worth of work, you know, my profit was right around like $71,000. That has to be $21,000 worth of expenses.
But you were driving the other half of that team, right? That's part of what's confusing your numbers, because if he made 31, then we would have to assume a driver to replace you would have made 31, so that 70 now becomes 39.
Yeah. Probably when the fuel surcharge is up a little bit higher too. I just did it too, and then yeah, you're right. It's not coming up right.
Yeah. So it doesn't mean. I mean, if I can generate $5,000 a month in profit on a truck, hell, I'll take that. That's good. That's $60,000 a year. Those are good numbers.
It's nowhere near
the numbers you are thinking of. I mean, it's less than half.
I agree.
But that's a much more reasonable number.
Okay. What about the whole corporation and thing? What, I mean, how much, you know, do you get an S-Corp if you have more than five trucks?
You don't have to have an S-Corp ever. You could operate as a sole proprietor and make $10 million a year. The IRS doesn't care. It would be stupid, but there's no point where we have to incorporate. We choose when to incorporate based on tax savings. And even if you only had your one truck with you driving it and a co-driver, you would want to be incorporated because there would be tax savings. If you had a second truck, then absolutely.
Okay, so do I want to incorporate with an S-Corp? Do I want to do LLC? What's the best way to go?
You would do an LLC and have it taxed as an S-Corp. I've got your 2015 numbers up here. 2015 revenue for all miles was $1.10 a mile. So that's 5 cents less than what I just did all the calculations on. After you got done paying the driver, you had 45 cents a mile left. If you had to pay another driver, then you can see there's not a lot left to pay him.
Okay. the miles you see, that's just not what I'm getting paid for. Like if I get home all the way from North Carolina to Florida, I'm still driving the miles I don't get paid for, but I still put that on the truck.
Well, you have to because that incurs cost.
That's right.
Why our software is set up the way it is. Because you have guys running around saying, oh, I make $1.60 a mile. Well, hell no, you don't. That's what your contract says. But that doesn't work in the real world. That's why we calculate it this way. It may not sound as good when people want to sit around and brag about how much they make, but this is real world. This helps us project, you know, what we're going to do business-wise. And I'm glad you called. And congratulations on having good accounting. I mean, it helps me to look at your numbers here and see what's going on.
Okay. All right, so just do LLC and...
LLC taxed as an S-Corp. I would be a little cautious. You had mentioned putting on two trucks. I would be cautious. There's not as much room for profit here as what you were talking about. I would just go slowly. I would work on getting the profit up on this first truck, then maybe think about adding one more. If you add two more too fast, it will be a disaster. I've seen it so many times. Let's go to... let's go to Mississippi. Ken, welcome to the program.
How you doing today, Mr. Rutherford?
Good. What can I help you?
Wanted to give you some praise. I've slowed down to just below 60. I still can't get it down to 55 all the time. Trying, but I can't.
Okay.
I've improved my fuel mileage on the last four tanks from just at 6 to almost 6.5 to 6 to 7. The other thing I've been working on at the same time is I've got a 13-speed Mac. I've been running in 13. Now I've dropped 12. Can I still drop that down to 11 and run and stay at the 55?
Probably not. When you're in 12th gear at say 60 miles an hour, where's the tack?
Right around 15.5. And unfortunately, I don't have the, but my boost, my intake manifold pressure, I've got a gauge for it, and it's down very low, especially on flat terrain. And my exhaust temperature, I've actually dropped it because I always thought it was running at 7 to 8, and I've dropped it down to where it's between 4 and 5.
Excellent. That's really good. And that's about perfect. And if we were to try to split another half gear, your RPMs would be up over 1,700. It's just going to be too high. Where you're running it right now is just about ideal.
Okay. See, the other thing I did was, the other alteration that I've made so far is I took my two stacks off and made a grass burner. I did it myself. We had some flex pipe that was already on the existing thing. I made a single exhaust instead of a...
Excellent. Hold that thought. I'm going to get to a break, and I'll come back to you right after this. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. If you haven't been there yet, go check it out. If you haven't been there in a while, go check it out again. We're always adding new resources. We have a webinar series we're starting to build. I've got the first webinar up. We have some free ebook and video, doing some more webinars and some more video. If you want to stay on top of what's going on, and the kind of things we can help you with, you can see the newsletter right there on the website. Just go to letstruck.com. Right on the bottom left, you'll see sign up. You can do that. If you want to get on our text message list, you can do that as well. And that's real easy. You just text the word listen to 99,000. So just like you were going to send the text, where you would put the phone number, you put a short code. That short code is 99000. And then in the body of the text, one word, don't worry about capitals or anything. Just type the word listen, hit send, wait 30 seconds or so. You should get a response back. And then every time we're doing a recording or a podcast, we will send you a text message with the phone number to join us, and you'll be in. I'm going to get back to the phones before the break. I was talking with Ken in Mississippi. Ken, go ahead.
The fabulous thing about the the exhaust was I did not have to spend a dime to do it.
Wow.
So
that
it
is
was
fabulous.
Because everything was there, and we cut the Y pipe off just before the Y, added the flex pipe, and was able to drop it, used the stack, cut part of it down, and used all the clamps. They had the compression clamps. We used those over again and fit it all together, and it just went in perfect.
That's outstanding. You know what's interesting? I was watching some video. I was doing some work this morning, and Bruce and I shot a movie. We did a video on building the original signature truck. And one of the comments he made in there, they do a lot of testing on exhaust and back pressure, and every 90-degree bend in an exhaust system builds the same amount of restriction as 13 feet of straight pipe. So when you simplify and get all those bends and Ys and all that stuff out of there, you really reduce back pressure, which is a good thing.
Now, how much would that have helped my fuel mileage then?
You know, there is a calculation on this. And I used to know it, but I haven't done it. If we measure back pressure, for every 10 points we improve back pressure, we improve fuel mileage by 1/10 of a mile per gallon, I think. So I would have to look at the old exhaust system, and I could run some, rough calculations, but it's pretty significant. And it's absolutely documented. That doesn't come just from me or from Bruce in Pittsburgh Power. I can find that formula and that calculation. It's just physics. When the longer the exhaust system is, the more complicated it is, the more turns, the harder the engine has to work just to push the exhaust out. When we make it nice and short and straight, the engine doesn't have to work as hard. We get better performance and better fuel economy.
Yep. It's definitely working, so I appreciate your help.
Good.
So, looking forward to seeing you at CMC.
All right, outstanding. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to Texas. Mike, welcome to the program.
Kevin, I'm like a kid in the candy store. Where do I start?
Where do we start?
First of all, yeah, I love your program. I love what you do for me and probably for all the other drivers out there as well. But, man, thanks for all the information and knowledge you share.
You're welcome.
Hey, I got this Volvo D13. I know it's one of your favorites.
Yeah.
Yeah. I bought the truck 2.5 years ago down here in the oil field, and it was great for doing oil field. You know, I was hauling sand. And
yeah.
It was great for that. I could go and sit on the pad for 2, 4, 6, you know, sometimes a day waiting, and there's so much room in this 780. I mean, guys would come and play cards anyway. But now I'm on the road. The oil field's kind of falling apart. I bought a step deck. I got my own authority. And, you know, like the caller before said, he's working to keep it at 60. Boy, I struggle with that. And I didn't know if that Pittsburgh Power could do much with this motor and what options there would be for them guys to do anything with this, you know. I've got 970, almost 980,000 miles on it. I've had it for, like I say, about 2.5 years. I've done really nothing to it other than a couple sensors, you know, a starter, batteries, that kind of stuff. But I don't go through any oil. I change my oil about every 23, 25,000 miles thereabouts. I use a gallon of that Lucas every time I do that. What else do I do to it? I have noticed recently that DPF, I got the filter, not the juice, just the filter.
Okay.
And it seems like it wants to regen more, you know, maybe once every couple of days. It used to be once or twice a week. Now it's going every couple of days, you know what I mean?
Well, let's start there. I've got several things to say. One, there are things Pittsburgh Power can do. We'll go through those all, starting with the DPF and the emission system. But before I get there, I have said that I don't like this engine. There are two reasons I don't like it. We can't get great fuel economy out of it most of the time. Most of the time we work at it, we struggle, we get it a little better, but nothing I ever really get excited about. And we don't get a lot of performance out of them. They're not horrible.
Right.
I mean, you'll get up the hill. But there is a good side to this engine. And the good side is it seems to break down a lot less than most other emission engines. That's a good thing. So
that's a great thing.
Yeah. So, you know, that I will say that there is a positive side to that engine. It doesn't seem to break down as much as the others. So one of the things that Pittsburgh Power has just recently developed, they haven't done one on a Volvo engine yet. So you might be the first if you wanted to go in and do it. What they have figured out is how to kind of recondition and tune up the entire emission system. And if you do that, we're finding a lot of benefits. Trucks that don't have problems will stay that way. Trucks that do have problems, a lot of times this will fix it. And what they do is literally go through and take the entire emission system apart, replace sensors that tend to fail and get clogged up with soot, clean out all the soot, and just kind of bring the emission system back to new. And they've got a couple engines they've done it on. It's not all that different to do it on different engines. They just have to figure out parts lists and things like that. So that would be one of the first things I would recommend. With that kind of mileage on it, tuning up that emission system would be excellent. They could do the Pittsburgh Power the Fleet Air Filter, the Fast Fuel System, you could possibly talk to them about a manifold. If they're going to be doing the emission system, they might be far enough in that you're not going to spend a lot more to have a manifold done. Now, the thing with that is on your engine, you've got to plan pretty far ahead because they've got to go buy the manifold, then send it out and have all the porting and polishing done on it and then have it ready when you come in. So you want to give them a call probably.
So They would take this one off and exchange it with.
Yes. Yeah, okay. They will go buy a new one and then send it out, have all the work done on it. So you want to call them ahead of time and kind of plan for this visit. But those are kind of the major things. They may be able to get into your ECM and play around and tune and tweak a few things. They're you know, developing programs for a lot of engines. But you would certainly come out of there smiling when they're done.
Yeah. Well, that's what we want to be, is smiling more, saving
that's
more
right.
fuel. You know, you
that's
had mentioned
right.
Something about just when I was talking, give you, is there anything there that I should be thinking about or worried about with that dumb filter?
The DPF, you mean?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's why you want to tune up that emission system. Because as that emission system gets more and more soot buildup and the sensors start to fail a little, the problems almost always manifest in the DPF itself. It's kind of the last part in the chain, and it will start clogging more often. It's already clogging more often. That's why you're seeing these frequent cleanouts on it.
Redens. Okay,
yeah.
That's all right. That's what's going on. Okay. Hey, one last thing that I let you go, and I say thanks again. One of the earlier callers talked about a balancer? No, not a balancer.
Yeah.
It was
a
crankshaft damper. Yeah, he's like changed a couple of those, and he's gotten, what, like 2 million miles? Is that what I heard him say? Is that something on this truck I should be thinking about? Because I haven't done that, and I don't know nothing about it.
It is, but let me get to a break and I'll come back and tell you why that engine is very unique when it comes to the damper. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to go back to Mike in Texas. So, Mike, the crankshaft damper, if you walk around the truck stop and open a bunch of hoods and look at almost every engine, at the bottom very front of the engine, you'll see a big round disc. That is the crankshaft damper. Look on your engine and you won't be able to find it.
No.
It on the Volvo, it's internal. It's inside the block instead of outside of the block. So, yes, it should be changed at like 500,000 miles or 5 years. But on the Volvo, it doesn't make any sense to change it unless you're doing an in-frame and you have everything apart.
Ah, I got you. Have they been known to cause trouble or don't you know that?
Here's the thing. If we got 100 mechanics and shop supervisors together and asked them if we could be replacing crankshaft dampers, my guess is at least 99 of them would say no. They don't think that this causes any problems, but it does. But the problems don't seem obvious. Like you'll start breaking brackets on stuff that's attached to the motor, air conditioning, alternator. You'll see some clutch and transmission problems. you get more vibration throughout the whole truck. So it's a little harder on the driver, but it happens so slow that nobody notices it. And they don't realize that a lot of the things that are breaking because that crankshaft damper isn't doing its job anymore. And it's hard on the whole driveline, but nobody ever replaced it because they didn't understand how it worked or why it goes bad. It's filled with silicon that is very soft in the beginning, and that's what absorbs all that torsional twisting and vibration. And over time, the silicon gets hard, and then it's worthless. It's not doing anything anymore. But the engine will still run. You won't be on the side of the road broke down. That's why nobody thinks we have to replace them, but you really should. Only on your engine you can't. Let's go to Ohio. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I found a new reason why I like my hotline fuel heater so much. They were explaining on a radio show earlier that fuel additives actually decrease the lubricity of your fuel, which in my opinion would shorten the life on your fuel injectors.
Well, we need to be a little more clear, because saying fuel additives is a very, very broad range of products.
Yeah.
That can be very different.
Anti-gelling.
Yep, that is true. Most of the winter fuel additives, when we're trying to solve waxing and water and those kind of things, they can reduce lubricity.
That's where you say do what the bottle prescribes, because more is not always better.
Yeah, and there's some other crazy things that can happen when, you know, one, we don't want to put too much in. We reduce lubricity even more. But two, sometimes the correct dose fixes a problem like waxing, but too much will actually cause the waxing to get worse.
Yeah, it was just something interesting. And I run a hotline which heats the fuel from the tank all the way to the filter, and I run gelled number 2 fuel in my tanks and got to the engine. I was able to hold a constant, never shut me down, basically. It kept me rolling.
That's a much better solution.
They're very nice. It's called Hotline. I don't remember who makes it, but I've filled up with number 2 when it was 30 below, and I never shut down. I kept on rolling.
Now, is the heating element on the hotline electric?
Yes, runs off your batteries.
Okay. So you could, I'm assuming, even on a very cold morning, you could turn the key to the on position and it would start to warm up the fuel lines before you try cranking.
Turn on the switch, walk inside for 5 to 10 minutes, walk back out, crank over the truck, and away you go, and let it warm up, you know, so it cycles the hot fuel back into the tank and circulates it, and then you get on the road.
Yeah, perfect.
But then you may have to let it sit for a half hour idling so it warms up all the fuel in the tanks.
Yeah, but that's a whole lot better than a service call.
Right, and I believe, I'm not 100% sure, but I do believe it's made by Arctic Fox.
That would be likely. I've seen some of their tank heaters and that, so that sounds about right. All right, I'm going to try to squeeze in some more phone calls here. Let's go to New Jersey. Danny, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing? I called earlier. I was on the Power Hour. I asked about the Power Box. I wanted to see if you take a look at my oil sample.
Got it. All right. I've got it here in front of me. How many miles was on the oil itself when you took the sample?
25,542.
Yeah, this sample is really, really clean. You are running a 10W30, right?
Yes, synthetic blend, Delo.
Okay, So the viscosity is 11.2, which seems low, but on a 10.30, that's fine. There, you know, looking at this sample, it looks like something really went wrong because you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 categories in the yellow. But all of those are additives, and they're virtually meaningless when I look at oil samples. The only reason they get flagged is because the lab is looking for one specific additive package, and yours doesn't fit the right profile. Sometimes that's because the lab sometimes has the wrong profile, and other times it's because the manufacturer has changed their additive package. Or once in a while, we see you could pull an oil off the shelf on the West Coast, pull the exact same oil off the shelf on the East Coast, and they'll have two different additive packages. And I'm not sure why or how, but it doesn't seem to matter.
I noticed the I think it was the calcium and the sodium, I think it was, that went up a little bit from my last sample. And what I figured on that was, since I run in the Northeast only, and Connecticut, Massachusetts, and all these other states in the Northeast want to put that liquid stuff all over the road, and it gets all over your truck, and it starts eating everything up, and you're sucking it through the air. So I figured that's why those went up.
It is, and yours is still really, really low. So even with that, it went up a couple points, but nothing to worry about. This is a really, really clean-looking sample. This engine's running well.
Thank you very much, and that's what I wanted to hear, because, I mean, from the last sample that I had taken, and you told me that my iron was up high, I noticed that my iron went down. I think it's at 34 now, and it was at 58 or 54, something like that.
Yeah. Looks really good.
I appreciate your feedback on it. And like I said, I'm going to get to Bruce, and I got to get that power box put on. I actually have one question real quick. I heard the guy mentioning about taking off the exhaust and making it a grass burner. Now, what I did on mine, I have a Pittsburgh Power high flow exhaust that I put on. But what I did was I eliminated the one that was underneath the cab, and I went with a straight pipe, and then the S-turn going up, an elbow going up, and then the S-turn into the Pittsburgh Power. If I was to remove that and put the Pittsburgh Power exhaust underneath and go with a grass burner, would that help me?
Does. It's a little hard sometimes to calculate what the help is going to be. But when we eliminate length, if we make a shorter system overall, we reduce back pressure. And anytime we can take out a bend, we reduce back pressure. So when you look at your system and you kind of lay out a new design, and if it's shorter and straighter, there's going to be an improvement. It's just sometimes hard to know how much.
Okay. Now, it'll also eliminate that stupid bracket-looking bracket that holds up the exhaust that's back there, too.
Exactly. Yeah.
That piece of steel and then the angle.
Yeah, I love a short, straight weed burner as long as we don't idle. Because, you know, if you idle, they're kind of a pain in the ass. But if you're not idling, then it is the best exhaust system for a lot of reasons. Less weight, less complexity, less things to go wrong, less things to replace, and less back pressure, which means better performance and better fuel economy. All right, I've got to get out of here. The music is playing. So many questions, so little time, but we'll do it again. So we'll see you then. Thanks for joining me. Be safe, be profitable, be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. Quick heads up, tomorrow will be kind of similar. We'll start off tomorrow with Destination Health, and then we'll carry on the second hour with general questions. So we'll see you then. Thanks.